I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up for this week. And of course, this is a radio show and podcast. We are on Red State Talk Radio on the weekends, both channels, both days. And also, we have a podcast. You can get the podcast on iTunes, as well as go directly to our website, throttleupradio.com. And you can get, well, we have an archive there, and you can pull out any number of episodes. Well, from time to time, we have special editions. And the special editions are designed to address a specific situation, a specific case, a specific area that, well, that I think needs probably more emphasis, more focus, if you will. And so that's the idea behind special editions. I actually enjoy doing them. It's a really pleasurable intellectual exercise for me. I really enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed talking about it, discussing it, and what have you. Okay, so just some footnotes here before we get started into the show. Footnotes are that we are in the middle of a pandemic, middle of a socioeconomic and medical crisis that has come from, from unknown places, perhaps. And so we're struggling. And yes, we have, we are focusing on this primarily, of course, that's to be expected. But I do think that we ought to carve out some space to consider other kinds of things, maybe consider some pleasurable things. I remember I got up this morning and I greeted the sunrise, and it was rather pleasant. I live in a in the Southwest in a mountainous area in the cooler months, and it's quite beautiful. And I was reminded of the fact that there is, in fact, beauty around us, and we are blessed in so many ways. And so I've thought that that was kind of helpful at least for me. And I'm sure that all of you are probably thinking of the same thing. Okay, the other footnote is that Throttle Up Radio is more of a conversation. Now, what that basically means is that we are not reading directly from a script. We have not memorized a script. So it is largely unscripted. What I do is I prepare and identify areas for discussion, but it's not specifically scripted. And most shows are more or less scripted. And so it's more of a one-way conversation, more of a speech, if you will. Throttle Up Radio is not that. Throttle Up Radio is a conversation. So it employs a conversational style. And basically what it is, this is the way normal people speak. So it's normal speak, if you will. It is a way that we can discuss things in a relaxed atmosphere, in a conversational atmosphere. And conversations come with it, with all kinds of things that humans do in a normal conversational arena. It's not necessarily polished, if you will, but my way of thinking is that if it is a normal conversational style, and if it's delivered in a way that is enthusiastic, then it's interesting to listen to. Otherwise, it gets a little bit boring. I was just as a point of reference, I often listen to and watch some short content videos, and there was this series of short content videos that I particularly like, and it has a lot to do with some of the things that I work on. But the audio portion of the videos had some pretty good graphics going with it, but the audio portion of the video was delivered in more or less a monotone. It was entirely scripted. The speaker was reading directly from printed material, and it was entirely scripted. And after about 5 minutes, it started to get a little bit boring. I noticed that my mind was wandering, and it sort of lost a lot of its ability to inspire, to challenge one's intellect, to add some additional things to the consideration that were outside the box. Okay, so keep it fresh and new and stuff like that. And so now I'm not saying that I do this perfectly, and I most likely don't, but my attempt here is to keep it fresh, keep it interesting, keep it new, offer things that are not necessarily mainstream, consider things that are outside the box, consider things that are more in the way of innovative, more in the way of creative, if you will, more in the way of new, fresh, and unusual, I guess you could say. Now, that's all part and parcel of this whole idea behind critical thinking and complex problem solving, if you would want to also include that. And we do. Higher order reasoning embraces both. Higher order reasoning embraces critical thinking and complex problem solving. I wish there was more effort to look at things from an abstract point of view, first and foremost. I like that idea. Okay, so what are we going to be talking about today? And, well, we're in the midst of this coronavirus situation, this pandemic, this crisis that we have encountered that was unexpected for almost everybody, caught us off guard, and we're going to be talking about that. But in starting my discussion this week, and this is, I guess you could say, it's a little bit beyond midpoint, I kind of see that we're getting through the end of phase zero, if you will, or the initial phase of it. And we need to, and I begin to see that there are some movements afoot to go beyond that and to start embracing or actually implementing phase one, recovery phase. And phase one, I noticed that some of the beaches in Florida are open or opening. Some of the golf courses in California have been opened. I was delighted to see that yesterday. Or we're in the Riverside County in Southern California. The golf courses have been reopened. I think that also includes golf courses in the greater Palm Springs area. That's one of my favorite places to play golf in the cooler months, of course. But great courses, great restaurants. It's a great place. I really enjoy the greater Palm Springs area. I'm particularly fond of Indian Wells. Spent a fair amount of time there, mostly playing golf, and very, very enjoyable. And so I'm glad to see that they are back open again, and they should never have been shut down, but nevertheless. So we're approaching the recovery phase very, very quickly. I think some of the states are already there in implementing the recovery plan and stuff like that. Okay, so here's what I'd like to do this week. And this is something that is actually gaining a lot of attention across the board, and I like that because there's more and more effort going into this whole area that we call critical thinking. And this particular aspect of critical thinking is creating mental models, or a little bit more specifically, we're talking about creating a mental model of this particular of a particular situation, but also in this case, creating a mental model of this coronavirus recovery initiative. We want to do something. We just want to sit back here and just give up. We are engaged in doing something about it. We have taken quite extraordinary steps along the way to slow the infection rate, to stop it, hopefully, in some form or fashion, and to get on with our productive aspects of our lives and our pursuit of happiness. So I like to look at this thing from the perspective of a mind map. Now, I'm not going to give you the whole mental mind map, if you will, the mental model, but mind mapping is a great exercise. It doesn't have to be perfect. That's one of the things that's missing. Anytime we create a model or another term that's sometimes used is an abstraction hierarchy. A model, mental model, mind mapping is a model. It's a mental model of a particular situation or situation space. So let's mind map this coronavirus situation. Okay. And so we can put, COVID-19 in the center circle, and then we have things radiating from it. We have orbiting circles around the central circle. It's kind of like orbiting planets around the sun, the central sun. And one of the things that is important for us to understand is what exactly is the situation? What exactly? How can we clarify the actual? That's one of the key aspects of critical thinking. How can we clarify what is actually going on and how should we respond to it? Okay, sure, we have lots of things going. We have respirators. We have access to respirators. We have access to testing. We have testing protocols. We have population segmentation and classification, testing certain segments of the population. We have disease trajectories in terms of mapping, contact, tracing, and stuff like that. And so, yes, disease trajectories are very, very important. Here we can use the computers to help us keep track of that and all of that stuff. And then we have the economic side. We have places that have stopped their certain segments of the economy have actually ceased to operate. They've come to a screeching halt. And so on and on and on, we can create a pretty good mind map of the situation. And I think that that's probably important. I would say that's probably what I can bring or I am bringing to the table with a certain amount of humility here. Of course, I don't have all the answers, but I do think that this is a valuable way for us to, begin to get a grasp of this situation. There's lots of moving parts. It's easy to get confused. It's easy to lose a sense of priority, sense of scale, sense of what is important now, how we should proceed in a nonlinear fashion. And so the mind mapping, the first thing I would do is if somebody asked me, I guess nobody is yet, but if somebody in the administration asked me what should we do to, let's say, enhance the daily press briefings, or what should we do to improve the understanding of all of the stuff that we're dealing with? And my response would be, okay, the first thing we do is we put on a big screen the mind map, and we identify all those factors and considerations going forward. And one of the things that really needs to be addressed is the reliability of whatever data we have available to us, whatever data we have collected. How reliable is it? What is the confidence factor of this particular set of data points or this particular data construct? What is the reliability of such a thing? And data does not come to us automatically with a level of reliability, or it doesn't automatically come to us with a truth table. We need to do that. We need to construct a figure of merit to identify or to focus on how reliable is this, and should we consider it as highly accurate or moderately accurate or inaccurate or replete with lots of noise. Often we get data that contains noise. Noise is, you know, something that came out of the audio electronic field, but noise is basically stuff that is being transmitted, stuff that is being turned into an audio file that's just gibberish. It's noise. Okay. So with that in mind, I'm gonna read this article, and I'll try to interject comments along the way. I'll try to keep it less monotone if I can and less boring. But I do think it's important for us. And again, I like to share ideas with you as I go through. I'm kind of like an idea curator in terms of putting together a show and discussing certain things, and also pointing out that here is something that someone else has produced that might be of interest to us. So we kind of have a big tent here, a broad brush, and stuff like that. Okay. Now, this is found, again, one of my favorite sources, not the only one, but one of my favorite sources is the Wall Street Journal. And this is found in the opinion section, the Wall Street Journal, Saturday and Sunday, April 18th and 19th. So it's a few days old, and it's going to be sort of like a week before you listen to this show unless on Red State Talk Radio. Anyway, the title of this piece, rather fascinating piece, and we're going to be following this up with a couple of audio clips that discuss the same thing. New data suggests the coronavirus isn't as deadly as we thought, by Andrew Bogan. And Mr. Bogan is a molecular biologist and is managing member of Bogan Associates. Okay, he starts off by saying that the COVID-19 shutdowns have been based on the premise that the disease would kill more than 2 million Americans absent drastic actions to slow its spread. He says that model assumed case fatality rates, the share of infected people who die from the disease, of 1-3%. The World Health Organization's estimated case fatality rate was 3.4%. Some experts, including in these pages, have questioned this assumption. They argue that known cases are likely only a small portion of the true number of infections, and thus, high case fatality rates could be off by orders of magnitude. Now, orders of magnitude officially, or I guess I could say technically, an order of magnitude is considered to be 10x. That's, now I'm not saying that that's what he's talking about, because order of magnitude is also a more of a colloquial expression as well as being a technical expression, but nevertheless. To continue, we don't know what portion of infections have gone undetected for lack of tests. Restrictive qualifications to get tested and a potentially large incidence of mild illness or asymptomatic infection. New data, he says, supports the skeptic's view. A preliminary study by a Stanford team released Friday. They conducted a, and this is a big technical word, I'm hopefully I can pronounce it properly, a seroprevalence study of Santa Clara County, California on April 3 and 4. They studied a representative sample of 3,300 residents to test for the presence of antibodies in their blood that would show if they had previously been infected with the novel coronavirus. He says the county where I live is home to about 2 million people in the heart of Silicon Valley, including San Jose, the state's third largest city. It has the largest known number of cases in Northern California and saw some of the earliest cases of community spread in the United States. The researchers, he said, found that the percentage of infections was indeed vastly larger than the roughly 1,000 known positive cases in the county at the time of the study. The preliminary results, the results will now undergo peer review, show that between 2.5% and 4.2% of county residents are estimated to have antibodies against the virus. That translates into 48,000 to 81,000 infections, 50 to 85 times as high as the number of known cases. That may sound scary, but it's great news, he says. It suggests that the large majority of people who contract COVID-19 recover without ever knowing they were infected, and that the U.S. infection fatality rate may be more than an order of magnitude lower than authorities had assumed. Based on this seroprevalence data, I'm not sure I pronounced it properly, sorry. Based on this seroprevalence data, the authors estimate that in Santa Clara County, the true infection fatality rate is somewhere in the range of 0.12% to 0.2%, far closer to the seasonal influenza than to the original case-based estimates. He continues, outside California as well, preliminary data are emerging to support a more hopeful picture. In New York City, a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine examined 215 women entering two hospitals to give birth between March 22nd and April 4th. These patients had a COVID-19 infection rate over 15%. Of expectant mothers who tested positive for active infections 88% were asymptomatic at the time of admission. That infection rate is about 10 times the rate of known cases in the city as a whole as of April 17th. And New Yorkers have been tested for COVID-19 far more extensively than residents of other states. This study, he says, looked only at active infections, not past infections, as in Santa Clara County. So in that population of pregnant women, 15% infected is a lower bound. Many others may have had a past infection, only detectable on serologic tests for antibodies against the virus. He continues, similar proportions of infections to cases are now being discovered around the world. 30 times in Urbino, Italy, 10 times in Iceland, 14 times in Germany, 27 times in Denmark. Germany and Denmark are now leading Europe in reopening their economies in the coming week. Sweden, concerned all along with the accuracy of early assumptions, never closed down its economy. This is not to deny that COVID-19 is more serious than influenza. Its symptoms are sometimes crueler, and it is fiercely infectious. It escaped the draconian lockdown of Wuhan and spread globally in a few months. In some places like northern Italy and New York, it has stretched hospital capacity and endangered or killed frontline healthcare workers. Tens of thousands are dead worldwide, and there's no vaccine. So, he says, a path forward demands continued monitoring, seroprevalence, as well as new case testing, identifying and protecting those most vulnerable to more serious or even fatal infections, and supporting hospital capacity to handle surges of respiratory intensive care patients. And then finally, he says, yet if policymakers were aware from the outset that the COVID-19 death toll would be closer to that of seasonal flu than the millions of American deaths predicted by early models dependent on inputs that now look inaccurate, would they have risked tens of millions of jobs and livelihoods? The science to support better modeling and decision-making is rapidly becoming available. One hopes that it will inform better policy decisions. Okay, that completes that article by Andrew Bogan. Now, that's a pretty good piece for all of us to consider, and it's not the only researcher, that's not the only person that is suggesting that we consider certain aspects of this that haven't been considered previously. So we're going to take a short break and we're going to come back and we are going to listen to a audio clip that is similar in its tone and proposals and propositions. I do think it's valuable for us. It's another researcher, a rather good, articulate, a very respected researcher that is going to be discussing similar things. And the whole point of this is to acknowledge that there are some great thinkers out there. There is a need for more in the way of looking at things critically. There's a greater need in the way of all of us to engage our ability to think critically as we try to avoid hysteria and try to understand how we can best respond to critical and impending catastrophe, critical situations and impending catastrophe. I would like to say that we are dealing with things that are mission critical. And what we need to do is we need to employ our mission critical responders to these trouble spots because they are specifically trained in these areas from a cognitive standpoint. All right, so we're going to take a short break and we're going to come back and we're going to listen to this rather interesting video and audio clip. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up after that short break. Now, we are going to continue our discussion here with respect to the data and understanding exactly what is going on with respect to percentages, with respect to numbers, with respect to categories and classifications. And here's where critical thinking helps us in a big way, because it first and foremost asks us or encourages us to clarify exactly what we are dealing with. What do we mean when we say something, when we produce something, when we establish a proposition? What exactly do we mean? And being very careful with the way we attempt to explain something that is complex, something that is not easily understandable, because there are certain aspects of it that are ambiguous, certain aspects of it that are uncertain and what have you. All right, we're going to listen to this audio clip. It's an interview with Dr. Bhattacharya, and he has done some rather interesting studies recently about this coronavirus. And it's being conducted under the auspices of the Hoover Institution. They have a number of outreach programs. I happen to think they're pretty good. I would recommend them, of course, to the curious minds out there, because they have some insightful stuff. All right, so here we go. Now, we're not going to be able to get all of it in, but we'll get a fair amount of it in, because I do think it's a rather fascinating interview, and it's a rather fascinating discussion by Dr. J. Bhattacharya. All right, so here we go with this audio clip.
A month ago, I interviewed my friend Dr. J. Bhattacharya, a professor of medicine here at Stanford, who holds both an MD and a doctorate in economics. That interview went viral. More than a million people have viewed it on the internet. Clips appeared on news shows of every kind. And Jay tells me that even his mother down in Los Angeles called to say she had seen it. In that interview, you may recall, Dr. Bhattacharya said that he would be testing on COVID-19 here in Santa Clara County. And back with us now to talk about the results, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. Jay, thanks for making the time, and welcome everybody to this special Plague Time edition of Uncommon Knowledge with Peter Robinson.
Thanks, Peter. Nice to be here.
Jay, the results. I'm quoting from your study, which is available today through MedArchive. Have I got that right? All right. It's available through MedArchive, and I'm quoting, quote, "The population-weighted prevalence of antibodies among those you tested here in Santa Clara County was 2.81%. This implies that the infection is much more widespread than indicated by the number of confirmed cases," close quote. And I read the study carefully for the bit that a layman had the best chance of understanding. You've got to explain this to us, Jay. What, briefly, the results, and then tell us how you conducted the study.
Sure. Well, why don't we start with that first, just so everyone has an idea of what we did. We drew a sample of people from Santa Clara County, basically using a Facebook targeted ad strategy. So if you got a Facebook ad from us, we were basically inviting you to come do a quick finger prick blood test to see if you have antibodies present. We looked at basically about 3,200 people in this drive-through testing facilities that we set up on the fly.
We're recording this on Friday. This is earlier this week or late last week?
Oh,
this
is about 2 weeks ago, I think.
2 weeks ago. All right.
2 weeks ago. So they took the finger prick, and then we just looked to see if the finger prick test showed evidence of antibodies to COVID-19. Now, why is that important? Because those antibodies imply very strongly that you had COVID-19 previously, some sort of infection with SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is the technical way to put it. Now 2.8, actually the numbers run, depending on your assumptions that we've made, somewhere between 2.8 and 4%, which doesn't sound like a lot. That means somewhere between 96 and 98% of people haven't got the
virus. Sorry, I have to ask layman's questions here. That sample of 3,000 and some odd people, you designed the Facebook ads to make that sample as random or as representative of the entire county as possible? Is that, you're trying to get a result that implies something for the larger population, but it's the larger population of what? The county?
The county, right.
All right.
That strategy worked very well to some extent. We also had to make some adjustments because a lot of the richer parts of the county, they responded to the ads at a higher rate than the poorer parts of the county. But we know how many people live in each of these rich and poor parts of town. So anyone who showed up from a poor part of the county, we counted essentially more than people who showed up from poorer counties.
Right.
So that when we did the final estimate, it represents the entire county, rich and poor alike, at the right proportions, as opposed to overcounting the rich. So with that procedure, we figured out somewhere between 2.8 and 4% of Santa Clara County has had evidence of COVID infection. Okay, so what does that mean? Right around the time when we were doing the study, there had been about 1,000 cases of COVID found, of COVID infection, active SARS-CoV-2 infection found within the county.
Right.
So there's about 2 million people in the county. If 4% have evidence of infection, that means that there's about 85 times more people who've had it per person that actually identified having it.
That's the critical finding.
Yeah, and if it's on the low end, it'd be 2.8, it'd be 50 times. So for every single person that the healthcare system in Santa Clara County is identified as having the virus actively in them, there are 50 people out there who had it and that never showed up with a positive test. It's the COVID infection is substantially more common in the population than we'd realized prior to the study.
All right. And I want to make sure that I frame the test correctly. It's my understanding, and I take my instruction in these matters from you.
Don't you have a pre-med son, Peter?
He's very much pre-med. So, Jay, you are using what is, so far in our experience with COVID, a new kind of test. Is that correct? You explained this in the last time we spoke a month ago, that the test that was being used to determine whether people had COVID at that moment was one kind of test. Another kind of test was being developed, technically, as I recall, more difficult to develop. And that test would test not only for whether you have the COVID infection now, but whether you have had it in the past and cleared it from your system. And that is what is now available. And your test, as far as I'm aware, represents the first rigorous, serious, important results from this new kind of test, correct?
I mean, it's that you characterize the test right. So the test that people have been using sort of early on in this epidemic is a test that checks to see if the virus is present. It's called a PCR test, RT-PCR test, for those of you who follow that kind of thing. What we're looking for is antibodies. So it's an antibody test. And of course, you produce antibodies a few days after you get infected. Those antibodies last, those actually, there's an active debate over to the extent to which those antibodies actually protect you from a second COVID infection or how long. But in any case, the fact that those antibodies are present are evidence that you were infected, even if the virus is gone. And that's what we're looking for, right?
So both. All right. So now, again, more on the results. There's good news, bad news here to the layman's mind. The bad news is, wait a minute, even by your high estimate, only 4% of my fellow citizens of Santa Clara County have been infected. We still have 96% of us to go. That sounds as though we're at the still at the very beginning. I've had it. I'm sick of this shutdown. And your results suggest that, in fact, the trouble is just beginning. The good news is, so tell me, the good news, bad news. Is the bad news not as bad as I think, as it feels to me?
I mean, okay, I'll start with the good news, right? So the good news is it's not as deadly as we might have thought. So if 50 people had it for every person that we've identified having it, well, previously we're counting the number of deaths, we divide by the number of people we think have it, and we say, okay, gosh, 1%, 2%, somewhere between 1 and 2% of people who have it die. But if there's 50 people who have had it and cleared it,
that your test now picks up.
Yeah. Then you get a much lower death rate. Now, there's some more nuance to that calculation that's not worth going too much into. The bottom line is that once you do that nuance, it's probably about as deadly as the flu or a little bit worse per case.
Okay.
So instead of having a death rate of, like the World Health Organization said, 3 in 100. So you get COVID and 3 out of 100 people die. Instead, our estimates suggest about somewhere between 1 in 2 in 1,000 die from getting infected with COVID. So that's the good news.
And what about the bad news? It fills me with a certain trepidation because it suggests we're just getting started. If you'd said 30% have been infected, I'd have felt more relieved. But am I understanding that in the wrong way?
No, I mean it is in some sense it's bad news, right? So the traditional strategy to control new epidemics involves a strategy called contact tracing, right? So okay, they find that Peter has the virus. Sorry, Peter.
Volunteer.
They quarantine you. They interrogate you and ask, okay, who else have you been in touch with? Oh, you've been in touch with Jay. Well, that means Jay now needs to get tested and possibly quarantined also. Or isolated, you keep tracking outside until you've characterized the full set of people that Peter has been in touch with, and the set of people that his friends have been in touch with, and so on and so forth, until you've sort of collared everybody that potentially could have it and tested them, and move outward. And every time you find a new case, you do the same thing over and over again until you've identified everyone who has it. So if this many people have it, that as we found, it is almost impossible to do that kind of contact tracing.
Because you end up with the whole population.
Yeah. Well, that's not, hopefully not the whole population, but it's certainly a very, very difficult challenge, even in the best of cases. But if you have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that need to get contact traced, then you just can't, there's no way to do it. It's just not a feasible strategy.
So back, if I may, to what the new information contained in your results about the coronavirus, this new coronavirus. Again, I'm summarizing things as best this little layman's mind can grasp them. But basically, we've been told there are three ways in which the coronavirus differs from the ordinary flu. And the first is the long latency period. You can go a long time without becoming aware that you have it. And the second, which is related to the first, is the high infection rate. What was it that I saw figures that each person who came down with COVID-19 infected three others? Well, of course, that's exponential. You'll end up in real trouble very quickly. Well, do your results affect either of those two?
That second number you said, that the three people infected, has to do with the policies that you follow. So if you have a shelter-in-place order, You're not, each person won't be infecting three. I mean, that's part of the reasoning behind the shelter-in-place orders.
So the latency period, what you've discovered is that the latency period is often infinite. lots of people get this thing and don't even know they've had it.
That latency period has to do with the biological properties of the thing, but it certainly has implications for what we found. A lot of the people that have it probably never knew that they had it, have it and cleared it. And they could have infected other people very easily. It is very infectious, as you say.
Even when you're totally asymptomatic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less likely that you'll spread it if you're asymptomatic, but it's possible. It just makes it very difficult. So, okay, one more corollary to that piece of bad news that I gave you earlier. economists like to deliver bad news, right? The disease eradication is probably not possible. Like making COVID go away altogether from the face of the earth is probably not possible.
All right. I can live with that because I think I've already adjusted my thinking to that. Here's the third way, the third fundamental way that COVID differs from the flu. And I'm just going to quote Dr. Anthony Fauci, and he's speaking early in March. Quote, I'm quoting him, "The flu has a mortality rate of 0.1%, 0.1%. This," meaning COVID-19, "this has a mortality rate of 10 times that," close quote. And your results say?
It's about the same as the flu on that order. It could be less, it could be a little more. Sorry, now the estimates, I guess, there's some nuance to them. And that latency period actually matters. So, we're presenting a conservative estimate. I think roughly it's on line with the flu. Like I said, it could be a little bit more. 1 in 1,000, 2 in 1,000. Not 1 in 100, 2 in 100.
All right. You're conducting another couple of tests very briefly. You've got one that is underway or soon to be started in LA County and another with MLB, the Major League Baseball organization. Just briefly tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So actually that the LA County study is in some way similar to that, to the Santa Clara study. But it's in a bigger metropolitan area that represents about 10 million people. That data collection happened last week.
Oh, so, okay.
That's all done. We're going to release the paper. Well, we sent it to a journal, and hopefully I can start talking about it very, very soon. The Major League Baseball study is with 27 different teams all around the country. Now it's the employees of Major League Baseball, not the athletes. In fact, it's mostly employees. So, concessionaires, front office and back office staff.
But that gets you closer to a sample that's closer to the way ordinary, right?
Representative. I mean, they're unique individuals working for a unique organization. But they are a picture into 27 different places very, very quickly with an organization that has fantastic medical personnel and fantastic people to help organize a study that normally to get into all those places all at once would have taken years. Because of it's Major League Baseball, now we're going to have a picture in those communities within a few weeks. We organize the study. It's actually
spectacular. And when will those results begin to become available?
Well, we just finished the data collection, so
you've done that as well.
Yeah, so we're
going to be busier than I thought, Jay.
I've been very busy this past month and some. I'm gonna try to write the paper this weekend. We'll see how far I get.
Okay, so that's very fascinating stuff, and more next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.